It's Ideasphere with David Gottfried, Green Explosion.
I've decided that technology is here for our regeneration. Green building and sustainability is doing great, but we're not getting there fast enough. So I think the problem lies in the human mind.
It's obvious that the root of any project is the idea. But when an idea becomes a passion that spreads to thousands, it sparks a movement. That journey began 20 years ago for the founder of the World Green Building Council. Hello, I'm Guy Rothbun. Welcome to Ideasphere, a platform for today's voices with inventor and author David Gottfried. In his latest book, Explosion Green, Gottfried shares the passion he felt at the dawn of the green movement, from his initial struggles to the introduction of the Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design, LEED. But his ideas go well beyond brick and mortar, as you'll hear. Mr. Gottfried joins me for this program. Thanks for taking this time.
Oh, it's great to be here, Guy, to speak with you again and to expand our story from before.
I want to pick it up on this because we're talking about the newest work now, Explosion Green. I want to pick it up in the introduction because one of your colleagues had a terrific thing to say in the respect of the real purpose of green building movement isn't to design, build, and operate green buildings. It's to improve lives.
Well, it's all about life. We think in green that it's about rating systems, it's about LEED, it's about technology, it's about codes and standards. But what we fail to see is that green building is actually about health, health of the planet, and health of everything living here. So you're absolutely right, it's about lives. And the lives are way beyond just us humans. We tend to think there are other things that were here before us.
Uh-huh.
And they will be here after us. The question is, will we still be here?
This is what you began looking at a number of years ago, and you use this work, your newest one, to introduce your personal life to us in the respect that you came out of college with the idea, because of your cousin, of being a developer. But your thoughts began to change over a period of time.
Well, it did start off with development, but out of college, I also learned to study and look broader at our impact. What is the impact of our energy consumption, our water use, and then applying those studies to the built environment made me want to look more broadly and see, hey, how do we contribute to water and aquifers? How do we contribute to climate change or the ozone hole? How do we contribute in homes and buildings to the people inside? What do we do to them? Is it healthy? Is it toxic? Is it productive? Is it creative? And so the dialogue went much deeper, both in terms of vertical depth and also horizontal into all these other issues, including the economy.
I remember reading years ago how much of our landfill is taken up with building material. It's a huge amount, as I recall, around 85 or 90% of our landfills. And then reading your work, I discovered that you had come across the information. Buildings consumed 40% of our energy, 20% of our water, and 40% of our wood. And with that, we put it back in the landfill.
Yeah, it's interesting. In California, the waste authorities were required to reduce landfill waste. And in order to get at that assembly bill, they had to get into green building because they found with the high percentage of recycling of debris from construction and demolition, they could get to those required goals and far exceed 50%, headed towards 90% waste diversion from C&D debris.
LEED, this is something that was non-existent 20 years ago in reference, but with your work with the green building corporations over the years, now it's recognized as the stamp of approval.
Yes, LEED is our green building rating system of the USGBC, the U.S. Green Building Council. We had the idea when we launched in 93, now 21 years ago, hard to believe.
Yeah.
And we built it up, and it became the world's biggest standard for green building. LEED is being used to certify buildings in 140 countries now. It's 300,000 buildings, 11 billion square feet. And if you figure an average cost of several hundred bucks a square foot, run that number. It's quite huge.
Yeah, it is quite huge. And you could not have anticipated this 21 years ago. I want to talk about your personal experience when you were trying to get people to listen. The wall that you ran into, no pun intended, with the building industry, but the World Watch Institute wanted to gut their building and essentially start from the ground floor up. They were more concerned about the economy than they were greening of their building.
Yeah, that was quite a discouraging meeting. I, at that time, was brand new to green building. I had convinced the principals, my cousins in our firm, to create this little green building group. This was back in 91, 92. And my big strategy was we'd go to all the environmental and health organizations in the D.C. area. There's so many associations there as well. And I had been reading World Watch's State of the World and loved it. And I learned that they were doing a renovation of their office space. I think it was on Massachusetts Avenue in D.C. And so I got a meeting, and I wanted to work with them to voluntarily shift the design and specification of their plans, which were already done, ready to bid. But I wanted to make them green. They weren't green. They were code compliant. But anything less, it would be breaking the law. And I thought it should be exemplar in terms of energy and water. And they just weren't up for it. And I was discouraged. And my principals that I worked with thought, well, if World Watch won't do it, then this isn't going to fly. And so
it was
depressing.
Have you had any contact since then with anybody inside World Watch on whether or not they would welcome the idea now?
Well, they have since then. They got on the bandwagon in their own space years later, and my understanding is they have done subsequent spaces that were green. I didn't have anything to do with it. For all I know, they don't even know they're in my book. But I still buy, even this week, I bought their State of the World 2014, and their Vital Signs was for last year because this year hasn't come out. So right. I think they are getting their own space needs in line with what they write.
And there's so much give and take in this. Something that you work with within your book now, pointing out that there are trade-offs no matter what. And World Watch was looking at the trade-off of going green or the economic downturn.
And also that was 20-plus years ago, and the green building industry didn't exist. LEED wasn't around. No one even knew what a green building was.
Yeah.
We didn't have the multitude of green product offerings we have now and the knowledge, which is becoming more mainstream, of how to do it. Mm-hmm. So it did back then add to the first cost much more than now. And now you can navigate almost at a zero first cost increase and still get a high return on investment as well of the measures you put in over the period of operations. So it's a lot easier to do it now.
Looking in hindsight, I couldn't help but be appreciative of something your father instilled in you, and that is, don't confuse the effort with the result.
Yeah, I still, right now, have his black paperweight on my desk. Some days I move it from the fringe of the desk to the center.
Yeah.
It's true. One analogy I use is if you play soccer or football, and I guess overseas they're the same, but the fans are looking at the scoreboard, and at the end of the day, who won has more points. And they don't hire the halfback or the kicker to just run up and down the field. They hire them to put points on the board. And so much of what we do, we're running up and down the field. We're not saving energy. We're not capturing and treating water. We're not making buildings healthier. We're not getting at the game that the earth needs to become regenerative.
In case you're just tuning in, Explosion Green is the book, One Man's Journey to Green the World's Largest Industry. David Gottfried, author of many other books, and we'll be talking about that as well. But you have a website, tweet, blog, or anything else you want to promote right now?
Yes. If you go to explosiongreen.com, you can find out information on the book. There's also a free sign-up for the Explosion Green Live Global Conference, and it's free the week of September 15th. I took the time to interview 40 of the best gurus of sustainability and green building in the world, and they're all there for you, from Mark Ruffalo, the Green Hulk, to Amory Lovins, who founded Energy Efficiency. And that's my gift to you, and it's free.
All right, I'll repeat that at the end of the show. Returning to the green home, what would be the most important points to look for in accomplishing that?
You need to decide how far you want to go. But you keep your budget. You don't necessarily have to spend more, but it's the trade-offs of how you use the budget. And I think goal setting is very important at that first meeting with your team. Are you going to use LEED for homes? Mm-hmm. If you're in California, we also have Green Point Rated, which is a home system. And many cities have home rating systems, such as Austin and other places. So you can look for those. And they're good guidelines. So you can go through that guideline with your architect, your team, and see how far you want to push energy efficiency. In California, we have Title 24 for energy, which is quite good. But if you want a great home, you know, set a goal like 50% better than Title 24. That'll give your team a lot of hours to try to think of interesting solutions.
Okay.
But if you set a goal like that, immediately that requires more insulation in the walls, under the crawl space, and in the attic. It requires good dual pane glazing, maybe even tuned to the solar exposure, looking at south and west. That west sun is beating up on the glass, so it might dictate how much glass and where you put it. Overhangs, so in the summer it's not coming into the space, so you have to cool it. So just that one goal is driving that, as well as the efficiency of your furnace and its sear ratio. You should be 90% or above. It will push into your daylighting how much, so you can have less lighting. And then when you do lighting, perhaps you can now go for LED, which is the latest and coolest and a good color spectrum. Your appliances, how much energy do they use? Are they Energy Star? Next, you'll move into water and set water goals. Try to rate your whole home for the water. You can get dual flush fixtures for your toilet, and some of the best come from Australia or other places. You can have aerators on the faucets and the tubs and the showers. You can have an efficient dishwasher, not much water, and also quiet, and a washer-dryer as well, that the front loading use less water. Your landscaping, maybe you could use local plants and not have a lawn and have a drip method or no water required, a xeriscaping approach. Mm-hmm. It's in the book. In our home that we did rainwater capture with 11 barrels around the house. I think the gray water systems that capture your sink, tub and shower waters will become standard, especially in places like California where we have a severe water drought.
We're just now starting to awaken to these things, and it's taken this, if you don't believe in climate change, at least you know there's a drought. To deal with a drought of this severity, it's time to make some changes.
We need huge changes in not just California, but all over the world. China, 2/3 of their rivers are bad and polluted, and they're soaking up their aquifers as we are in California, and it's dropping. Lake Mead is dropping to supply Las Vegas. San Jose and Silicon Valley is getting hammered, Atlanta, Georgia, Australia and Queensland. And so much of that is going to agriculture. About 77% of the water in California is for agriculture. 10% of our water goes into almonds and 50% into our hay. And then we export it globally. So in a way, we're exporting our water overseas.
Yes.
In the form of almonds. And you know what? I love all those things, but we can't afford it. That we also waste in our homes with our lawns, our pools, our leaks. And every drop of water should be captured and used, not running down black asphalt, which has a heat island effect, and then getting treated with tons of energy and water loss again and then sent to the bay. Mm-hmm. That's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. We need to wake up.
Looking at the situation we have for energy usage, there's also the nuclear power question. That's going to be lingering for a long time to come. But now President Obama is looking at curbing our greenhouse gases through the coal industry. There's Senator Bonner, who is not in favor of these changes. Are they too severe?
No, not at all. And good for Obama. He couldn't get Congress to do anything, and so he's using executive order to go at it. He's pegged it at 30% reduction. He's got a flexible executive order, so it could be coal, but it could be other measures as well. And I think he's right on. I think going anything less would be negligent, and it's about time we wake up that the climate is heating up. We've crossed 400 particles per million of CO2. We're actually at 401 right now, and the scientists say 350. And we've got about 15 years, according to the intergovernmental panel that puts out all the good UN science. Mm-hmm. And they say, you know, you got 15 years, get at it. And we're only a third of the way at about 10% from the 2005 level. So I think Obama's right on, and I actually think Earth needs more than that, but to try to politically put through more would have been hard, so he's pushed it as high as he can. He's trying to create his legacy, and I might have pushed it a little harder and higher, but then I would have more backlash. And now I want him to take on water and do the same thing, requiring a 30% reduction in water in the U.S., in the places that the aquifers are being drained and have drought conditions.
The book is Explosion Green, One Man's Journey to Green the World's Largest Industry, author David Gottfried. This is Ideasphere. I'm Guy Rothbun. We'll be right back. You're back with Ideasphere, a platform for today's voices, author and educator John Kuhn, Fear and Learning in America. Something we need to discuss is what this can mean to teachers, how this could be pushing back on them. The test scores are not effective, but if the school does not rate higher from those test scores, there is the issue of whether or not the teacher's failing. And in many cases, as you have witnessed, that's not the issue at all.
Yeah, I think it's far more simple than that. And unfortunately, a lot of our politicians in both parties have kind of accepted uncritically this notion that bad test scores mean bad teaching is going on. There are a lot of things that impact test scores. a lot of those things have nothing to do with the teacher. I've mentioned in this program today, school funding differences. Well, that's the politician's fault. You know, if they don't have the courage to direct funding to where it's needed and they want to take the path of least resistance, how can teachers be held to account for trying to get the same results with less resources? It's exactly what we do. Another thing that is hard to account for is the difference in student populations that teachers receive depending on where they're at. So there's an unfortunate consequence of this, which, by the way, is now being enforced from the federal level. The U.S. Department of Education is requiring states to evaluate teachers based on the standardized test scores of their students. That's going to have a few effects that I think are counterproductive. One is it's going to make standardized testing even more the focus of what we do in schools. And in my opinion, there's a lot more to what education is supposed to be than just getting math and English discrete facts drilled into kids' heads. There's so much more to it than that. But since that's what's on the test, that's what drives things. But the other thing evaluating teachers based on student test scores does is it dissuades teachers from going to work in the toughest schools where the needs are the greatest. Again, you mentioned counterproductive early on in this conversation with the funding. We don't want to drive our best teachers away from our neediest schools. We want to drive them to those neediest schools. That's how we fix things.
What one is going to come away with your work is the personal aspect that you add to it. One is that the pain you feel when a student cannot pass the required exam, and you have that example very early in your book. And then later you have a personal story. The confrontation with a troubled student leads to an arrest.
That's from my experience. I think a lot of times when people weigh in on education, a lot of times we hear these suggestions and ideas and innovations that are supposed to fix everything. A lot of times the people that come out with those prescriptions don't have the experiences that teachers and students and parents who are living that public education experience have. And so many of the prescriptions that I've seen come along during my career have really missed the mark. They've been kind of clumsy attempts to fix things. And because of that, a lot of times they amount to little more than fads, and they're here today and they're gone tomorrow. So teachers are kind of constantly dealing with this. And so one of the things I'm trying to do in the book is express some of the nuance and the context of what schooling is. And I think that context is vital so that when we implement policies to try and guarantee a quality education, we have to acknowledge and honor the context of what's going on in the schools.
You're looking at the changes necessary in funding, and the property tax that is used for funding is where the distortion comes from at the moment, because in a more expensive community, the higher the taxes, the more that school receives money. And it affects the smaller communities or the less expensive communities in a very negative fashion. Do you feel that America then, Americans, are going to be able to accept that my tax dollar is going to be equal in its distribution to all schools?
I don't know politically if the people of the United States will accept that or not. I know that in the state of Texas, we have been battling over this idea for decades. In fact, we are currently in our seventh lawsuit dating all the way back to the 1960s. And these lawsuits going back and forth all along, they've been about how tax dollars are invested in educational services. And, you know, there's the concept that my tax dollars from my community should stay here and they should benefit the kids here. The answer, in my opinion, is to avoid that conversation and that fight over local tax dollars by funding education through some other means of taxation, either a statewide property tax or a state sales tax or a state income tax, but something so that people don't feel entitled to greater investment in their children than their neighbors receive. I think fundamentally that's a destructive policy to invest disparate amounts in different kids around the state. You know, I don't know next year if I'm going to live in where I live now or if I'm going to move to another town, but as a dad, I would like to know that wherever I go, the schools are equally supported. I compare it sometimes to the interstate highway system. We have an interstate highway system that as you drive across the state, you know, the road is, it's asphalt the whole way. It doesn't turn into a gravel road when you go through poorer areas. And the reason we have that is because we don't want to tear up our cars. Well, we shouldn't want to tear up our kids either. There should be a minimum guarantee in all the states of what any kid of any ethnicity, of any background, of any socioeconomic status, there should be a minimum guarantee in the states of what kind of education that child should get. And we're failing on that. We've made that promise in our constitutions, but we're failing to deliver it.
And what you see also is the lack of voice for the teachers and the students as the funds are being distributed in an unfair fashion.
Yeah, and you know, I think honestly, teachers don't even realize it. Until I became an administrator, I just assumed that wherever you went to school in Texas, you got X number of dollars to educate a kid, and that was just how it was. So teachers may not even realize that some of them are starting out behind the starting line because of funding inequity. Teachers that I work with and that I've worked with over my career, they have a pretty single-minded focus on their subject and their classroom and their kids. They go in and they teach their classes and they do their job. And, you know, a lot of times they're kind of blissfully unaware of the politics that surrounds all this. I know I was when I was a teacher, but now that I've become an administrator and started looking at budgets and started paying attention to the inequity, it's very frustrating to be held to the same accountability standards as every other school in the state, knowing that there are schools that are disadvantaged by the funding.
Something that is going to have to happen if we're going to have a dialogue is for the media to step up to the issue and start discussing all sides of this. The problem is you don't hear what we're talking about right now. You just don't hear it. Is there another approach you see that might be more beneficial?
You know, I'm not sure how to force the conversation and how to get the media to listen to the side of public school teachers and parents. I think what I've seen happen in Texas recently, in 2013, we had a group of moms. They formed an organization called Texans Advocating for Meaningful Student Assessment, and they were extremely active in recruiting parents from all over the state, and they were extremely assertive with our state legislators, and they actually were extremely successful. At the end of the legislative session where they were so vocal, the legislature restored some of the $5.4 billion of education funding that it had cut the previous session, and the legislature reduced the emphasis on standardized tests. The previous session, they had required 15 standardized tests for a student to graduate. The student had to pass 15 tests. After this group of advocate moms got finished with the legislature, they changed it to 5 tests. And these moms are promising to be active again next session. I think we see in New York a very vibrant movement of parents opposing some of the test and punish policies in that state. I read this morning that there were 66,000 students whose parents refused to let them take the most recent standardized test. So, you know, in my opinion, it's somewhat sad that some people feel like they have to resort to civil disobedience to have their voices heard. But like you noted, the conversation seems very one-sided, and there's a lot of money and power behind certain aspects of the education reform movement, and there's not a whole lot behind the public school parents who have concerns about overtesting. You know, they're just kind of grassroots.
Mr. Kuhn, thank you so very much. It's been a pleasure with reading your material, and I think you have some issues here that I hope others will address.
Well, I thank you so much for the time today. I enjoyed the conversation, and thanks for having me on.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Fear and Learning in America, John Kuhn. You can reach him at Twitter, John Kuhn TX. That's JohnKuhnTX. If you have any questions about these broadcasts, write to me at rathbunproductions@gmail.com. This program is a distribution of Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org. For Ideasphere, I'm Guy Rathbun.